From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the connection between the militias and the white supremacist movement. We talk with Michael Reynolds of the Klan Watch Project of the Southern Poverty Law Center. He monitors the militias for white supremacist activity. Racism and anti-Semitism have often unified blacks and Jews in a common struggle. But the alliance that was forged during the civil rights movement seems to have broken apart. Coming up, we talk with Michael Lerner and Cornel West about their ongoing dialogue on black-Jewish relations. Lerner is the editor of Tikkun, a magazine of Jewish political and social commentary. West is a professor of Afro-American studies at Harvard. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Michael Reynolds' mother lives 5 miles from the federal building that was bombed in Oklahoma City. But 2 days after the bombing, Reynolds was at a gathering of extremists, many of whom believe it's time to arm themselves against the government. Reynolds was there to monitor the Militia Patriot Movement for white supremacist activity. He heads the Militia Task Force for Klan Watch, a project of the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama. The center prosecutes white supremacist groups and disseminates information about them to the press and government officials. This week, Morris Dees, the head of the center, sent a letter to state attorneys general urging them to shut down private militia groups. Timothy McVeigh, a suspect in the Oklahoma City bombing, is reported to have been involved in the militia movement. The conference Michael Reynolds attended on April 21st was the second annual super conference of the International Coalition of Covenant Coalitions, held in Branson, Missouri. It was a gathering of followers of the extremist, white supremacist theology known as Christian Identity. Representatives of the militia movement were also in attendance. I asked Reynolds how people at the conference talked about the bombing.
This supposed religious gathering, there wasn't one prayer offered. You would think that some prayer for the loss and the injured and the dead would be offered, but it wasn't. The remarks made from the podium went from no sympathy and references to Waco, that no surprise that such an event would happen to the federal government because they were responsible for Waco, all the way to paranoid prayers to deliver the Christian patriots from the Antichrist government that had planted the bomb in order to discredit them, to several cases, where they were delighted in the bombing.
Delighted by the bombing?
Yes, not from the podium, but that was expressed by several men who were there. To me, that in one instance, this fellow who was from Oklahoma, I was speaking with, said, "We've been losing this country piece by piece, but we got a piece of it back in Oklahoma City." And then he laughed.
Were you trying to pass yourself off as a member of one of these extremist groups or sympathizer?
Well, I was just there in that capacity, not vocally, but yes. I mean, I was not there in the capacity as a reporter, or certainly not from Klan Watch. In a sense, yes.
So, what did you do to fit in?
Well, just knowing that I'm familiar with the issues and familiar with the identity tenets and. Dressed appropriately, and
which was how
I just had. Well, that's another thing. I was dressed, you know, in clean jeans, and these people are not coming out of the woods in some hayseed manner. The appearance were from everything from long-haired guys with their hair brushed back, wearing Birkenstocks, and there were several of those, and sock, you know, they had thick socks on and Birkenstocks, and they had their lovely wives and their lovely children, and sort of post back to the land hippies from the 60s to ladies that you would encounter and gentlemen you would encounter in the shopping mall to farmers and people from small towns to some ex-cons, and it was an interesting mix. It was like if you go to Walmart, you would see these people. They're just people like us. So there wasn't any identifying badges and so forth that were being worn. There were the militia types with their aggressive T-shirts on. But other than that, it was like a gathering anywhere in the middle of America.
Did you learn anything about extremist groups at this conference that you didn't know before?
Well, one of the things that that I went to see, it's not so much their message and their conspiracy. I was familiar with that. I wanted to see the makeup, getting back to the group, the makeup of age group, who was there. And the alarming thing that I discovered at that meeting was how many were from age 50 down into the 20s, not speaking of all the children that were there, but that there was a younger element in this identity gathering. Because sometimes, looking in the past as identity began, and sort of puttered along from the late 40s into the 70s, it was made up mostly of older citizens from their 60s on up. Now there's a third and fourth generation, and this is what I saw in Branson, and this is what alarmed me more than the rhetoric I was expecting.
How did Klan Watch, which monitors racist activities in America, start studying the militias?
Well, the militia, what we refer to as militia, what we're looking at is really paramilitary activity. And paramilitary activity out of the racist right has been with us for decades, going back to Louis Beam, who is a grand dragon and now is a major strategist in this movement, formed a Texas Emergency Reserve out of the Klan in Texas, and they had paramilitary training there. Some 2,500 people, men, attended this, and the goal was to drive the Vietnamese fishermen from Galveston and the shores of Texas. Southern Poverty Law Center, Morris Dees, got an injunction using paramilitary laws. Well, that was in the beginning of the 80s. After that followed the White Patriot Party out of North Carolina that dropped their Klan robes and began training some 1,000 of them in paramilitary tactics and trying and acquiring fully automatic weapons, and had a declaration of war. Then there was the Order that sprang up, which was a paramilitary underground terrorist unit that came out of Aryan Nations and Identity, led by Bob Matthews. So in the course of this, we've seen this by monitoring the racist right, and each phase of this development has become a bit more sophisticated. They've learned as they've gone along. But those extremists who are willing to use violence to achieve their ends are attracted to such a movement. And so our interest in them dates much further back than just recent years. So when they started, there were individuals and groups appearing within the militia movement, leaders and strategists such as John Trockman of the Militia of Montana, who was a longtime Aryan Nations advisor, spoke at their, was a featured speaker at their 1990 World Congress individuals such as that that have such influence in this militia movement now, that puts a red flag up in what we do here. So that's how we got into it.
Do you think a lot of people on the racist right moved from the Ku Klux Klan into militias? And if so, what could the explanation be for that?
Well, we've seen a demise of the Klan. The Klan itself, the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, the Invisible Empire. The Southern Poverty Law Center has gotten judgments against the Invisible Empire and United Klans, effectively dismantling them. They have been at each other's throats, different leaders, over the last 2 years, to where there is no united Klan. And this new generation is not attracted to going out and wearing robes and burning a cross, but the militias dressing up in camos and getting some weapons and going out in the woods and meeting together and doing paramilitary training, that's a different attraction. And also it puts a different face on it. And the face of the racist right now is this paramilitary militia face rather than the guys wearing the hoods and marching down the street.
It sounds like some of the militia leaders who have come to the militias from overt racist groups are not as overtly racist within the militia movement. Does that mean that a lot of the people who aren't in the leadership in the militia movement might not actually be racist themselves? They might not see the militias as racist groups.
Exactly. This is one of our concerns, and one of the reasons that Morris sent the letter to Janet Reno, and we have came forth last fall with this information is because. Most of those who are attracted to the militia movement are really dissatisfied with the federal government, or they're dissatisfied with land or water issues, and they've gotten together. They're really political clubs that have been forming, and some of them are simply exercising what they see as their Second Amendment rights, the anti-gun control. Okay. Those folks are out there doing that and have no racist agenda, have no violent agenda. However, the situation where you have the Kernkeys and the Trockmans and the Lewis Beams and others like them driving inside this movement, they are attracting many people who don't know what their agenda is, and they're contributing money and getting involved in the movement. And at the same time, we will see, and we have seen, those citizens who want no part of that drop off. And the Oklahoma City bombing was the threshold. That was the event, and we've seen that. The Oregon militia has disbanded because of that and gone public. However, the hardcore extremist element in the militia movement has just become harder and will attract more like-minded individuals who are willing to act out. And that's what we will see in the months and the year to come.
My guest is Michael Reynolds. He monitors white supremacist activity in the militia movement for Klan Watch, a project of the Southern Poverty Law Center. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Reynolds of the Klan Watch Militia Task Force, which monitors militias for white supremacist activity. Some of the leadership of the militia movement is connected with the Christian Identity Movement, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about that identity movement. Mm-hmm. This is a religion that seems to be based on racism. Let's talk about some of the couple of premises, a couple of the basic premises. African Americans are called mud people in identity. What does that mean?
Well, in the identity sect, there is the Adamic man, that is the white man. And in their interpretation of the word Adam means Adam, to blush in the face, meaning white. That there was more than one creation. Before Adam, God created people of color who were beasts, according to identity, in the sense they have no souls. These were people of color. Then there was Adam. Then there was Esau and the Edomites, which are the Jews. And they, in turn, moved out and interbred with the beasts, the people of color. And those are the enemies, the forces of Satan, the forces of evil. And that this world, God's chosen people are the white people. So there, in a very simple form, is how it's laid out according to identity. And they use interpretation of the Bible, Old and New Testament, to justify this system.
Now, I believe that feminists are also part of the hate agenda. Let me read a paragraph from some identity literature. The militant feminist movement is another weapon of Satan, promoted and pushed by the U.S. government to dethrone every white man in America. Satan's plan is to replace every man with a woman or a wimp and to have them occupy the man's place until Jesus comes.
That's true. They view the Constitution in this way. When they talk about the Constitution, they're talking about the first 10 amendments and the Articles of Confederation. And they refer to those documents as being given by God. And then they refer, that's the organic Constitution, those are the sovereign citizens of America, the Republic. Then there are the 14th Amendment citizens who are state citizens, and these include, of course, women, people of color. Anything after that is something made by this government, which is not lawful. So women wouldn't, in their ideal world, would not even vote.
You mentioned the 14th Amendment, and I have some literature here from Pastor W.N. Otwell. I guess he's very important in the identity movement.
Well, he is a player in that identity dominion theology. It's not just identity. They also have a very good fit with something called Reconstructionist Christianity, which is also dominion. The whole view of Otwell and others coming from not just identity, who share this view that this country should be run according to biblical law by white men. Otwell is a player in that. Yes, he's definitely so.
Well, he writes, I do not write this pamphlet of my public commitment and purpose of commitment with the spirit of trying to be hateful or unkind or to discriminate against anyone in an ungodly way, even though we have to make a difference in what is right and what is wrong. My aim and goal is to tell the total truth about this present godless government system and its ultimate goals. I believe without reservation that the white man was God's man to build America, and by God's help and God's grace, the country would always be the head of all nations and not the tail. America is to be a Christian nation. The Constitution of the U.S. mandates that this nation is to be Christian. What I mean by the Constitution is the first 10 amendments called the Bill of Rights. That's God's Bill of Rights. The web that began with the addition of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Bill of Rights, which ultimately led to abolishing states' rights, will over a period of years destroy every individual's God-given rights. We are right now at the verge of a total socialistic government under Bill Clinton with his crime bill, gun bill, and health care package and his present budget. So basically what the 14th Amendment did was, the 13th Amendment outlawed slavery, and the 14th Amendment said that anyone born in the United States could become a citizen. So it meant that African Americans born in the U.S. could now be citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the 14th Amendment is such a profanity within Christian identity?
That's right. You've summed that up well, that this is an example of what they refer to as the de facto government imposing a law that is contrary to God's law.
You had the Militia Task Force for Klan Watch, which is part of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and you've investigated the militias. You've investigated racist connections to the militias. What do you think the difference is between the official positioning statements of the militias, their official reasons for existing, and some of the more underground reasons that you found?
Well, the official or public face of the extremist militia groups and their supporters is based on several events. They cite the Weaver standoff and that tragedy up there, Waco, what happened there, then the gun control, assault weapons ban, and the crime bill, the elements of that, and the Brady Bill, as examples that the federal government is just taking away our rights and is a threat, okay? Now, driving underneath that is something much darker, and it is not just those issues that many Americans can share sympathy with. I wasn't pleased to see what happened in Waco or at Weaver. There were mistakes made there. That's obvious. But beneath that is taking these issues that many Americans share. But then when you get deeper into what they really intend and what they subscribe to is an all-out assault, a violent agenda of civil disorder against the federal government in terrorist acts, the legitimacy of using violence against federal government, state officials, law enforcement, abortion providers, any of that, where you read this justification for violence, and then coupling that with, and here's how to go about it. That's what we're looking at, and that's what we consider dangerous, is the dissemination of how to construct demolitions. I mean, you take that step further and further. That's what's operating beneath. That's not something that they're publicly stating, here's what we advocate as you go out and blow up a building. But at the same time, they're disseminating information on how to construct bombs.
You know, from what you're saying, I get the impression that what you're finding is that when one racist group is successfully prosecuted under the law, racism just expresses itself through another group, heads in another direction. Do you find that very discouraging?
No, that's the work. If they have to keep moving and changing their tactics, we will keep moving with them. And as long as they act out in that way, we'll be there, and it's a situation that is not ending, obviously, but we're not going anywhere, and wherever they go, we'll be there watching them.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Michael Reynolds works with the Klan Watch Militia Task Force, which monitors white supremacist activity in the militia movement. Klan Watch is a project of the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, blacks and Jews. During the Civil Rights Movement, they were in alliance against racism, but that alliance seems to have broken apart. Cornel West and Michael Lerner have collaborated on a new book called Blacks and Jews as part of their ongoing dialogue on the subject. West is a professor of Afro-American studies at Harvard, and Lerner is the editor of Tikkun, a magazine of Jewish political and social commentary. We'll talk about their personal and public dialogue coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the Civil Rights Movement, there was a strong alliance between blacks and Jews, based in part on a shared understanding of discrimination and shared liberal politics. But that alliance seems to have broken apart. Cornel West and Michael Lerner have an ongoing private and public dialogue on relations between African Americans and Jews. They collaborated on the new book, Jews and Blacks, Let the Healing Begin. West is the author of the bestseller Race Matters and a professor of Afro-American Studies at Harvard. Lerner is the editor of Tikkun, a magazine of Jewish political and social commentary. After their new book was published, they went on a speaking tour together with stops at synagogues, churches, schools, and universities. Their question and answer session with students at Howard University was shown on C-SPAN. The alliance from the Civil Rights Movement days seemed distant and slightly irrelevant to some of the students. I asked West and Lerner if any of the students' questions surprised or disturbed them. West spoke first.
Throughout the tour, there were many who said to me, look, Brother West, we're trying to heal ourselves. We must heal within the black community first and in no way go outside of the black community. Don't you know we can't trust anybody? We're in the world by ourselves, that the larger white majority hates us, and the Jews are part of that white majority, and therefore for you to call for an alliance in a way is self-destructive, and that we did hear that oftentimes. And I do, in fact, take it quite seriously in terms of the need for self-empowerment, self-love, self-respect, self-healing within the black community. I'm just convinced that that activity must go on alongside and will be empowered by the healing of blacks and whites, blacks and Jews, blacks and browns, blacks and yellows, blacks and red.
Then let me tell you an impression I got from the Howard Q&A, and I didn't see the whole session, so I might be making a false conclusion. But the impression I got from the African-American students was, listen, the whole idea of a black-Jewish alliance and the state of that alliance might be important to you, but, you know, it just really doesn't matter to me. And it's just not an issue to me.
Well, that's part of the inward-looking perspective that I was talking about. But again, that was put forward only by a small number of students. I mean, so many of the students were asking general questions about what possibilities were there, and how do we understand the relation between past and present in this regard? But it's true that there is an inward-looking perspective that's quite strong in black America, and understandably so, given the fact that black folk have been isolated and targeted in such a vicious and pernicious way. But I don't think that the dominant orientation among the young people was one of the alliance makes absolutely no difference at all. They were just curious about the possibility of it, that's all.
I had some different impressions. I don't know if you want to hear them, Terry.
Yeah, I do want to hear them.
I was very disturbed by things that happened at Howard, even though I agree with Cornell that the majority of students did not support those questions. And I had the same experience a few days ago in Los Angeles at a we went to an African-American bookstore in which I was the only non-African-American in the crowd. And again, I felt like the level of anger and hostility coming at me was so shook me that I think for about 2 hours afterwards, I could barely say a word to Cornell. I mean, I was just so upset with it. And there have been other places, a group of a Nation of Islam people who marched into the MIT auditorium where we were speaking Monday night in kind of military formation. And then when asked a fairly hostile question and when Cornell tried to answer it, they said, "We don't want you to be providing a buffer for this guy. Let him speak. The question is to him, not to you," trying to say blacks and Jews shouldn't be together in that way. And I was upset with many of the questions. I was upset with that question that implied that there, what's the point of having a black-Jewish alliance? But I was also upset in many of the questions I received at other places with people suggesting, for example, that, oh, the Jews had never been in slavery, so we had stolen this this whole notion, and that we were lying, our religion was based on lies, and that the Jews ran Hollywood and the Jews had all the wealth and power in American society, over and over again, one anti-Semitic canard after another that I was hearing. However, I do have to say also, Terry, that I was hearing that from a distinguishable small sector of the population, and we had an experience in L.A. with that was in the L.A. bookstore was with about 40 people, but we had an experience in L.A. with a House of Blues, a big jazz club that was packed with about 800 people, 400 of whom were African Americans, most of them between the ages of 20 and 40, and they were so enthusiastic about this and so excited about the possibility of a connection, and the vast majority of people, not just the kinds that you'd expect from churches and sort of older or more conservative folks, but young African Americans, the vast majority of them expressing enthusiasm about the possibility of a black-Jewish alliance was really surprising to me also. So I had both the surprise of the negativity and the upset around that and the surprise of the positivity, which I also didn't expect.
Now, I want to say that the House of Blues audience each had to pay $22.50 a ticket, and that might have affected who showed up, in the sense that usually when you're paying for something, it's something you really already support and agree with.
Well, they a lot of them had come to pay also for the there was a Watts rap group that was going to be playing afterwards, and and they paid to come to that, and they came early to hear us.
I see.
And so it was the Watts crowd that had that was quite surprising, because they I knew that they were the Watts crowd because they weren't there at 7 when we started. They came in around 8 o'clock, and then they stayed for about an hour of our interaction. And in that hour of interaction, they moved from sort of passively standing in the back drinking at the bars there to actively engaging and being excited about what they were hearing.
My guests are Michael Lerner and Cornell West. They've co-written the new book, Jews and Blacks, Let the Healing Begin. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Lerner and Cornell West, co-authors of Jews and Blacks. I would imagine that one source of probing questions that you each got had to do with the Nation of Islam.
And Farrakhan.
And
here we disagree, as you probably know from reading the book.
Mm-hmm. Tell me where you disagree on the meaning of on the place of the Nation of Islam within American political discourse now?
Well, from my standpoint, the Nation of Islam is an overtly racist and anti-Semitic and not to mention sexist and homophobic organization. And it puts out material. In its bookstore, it supports things like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and other classic anti-Semitic texts. And in its statements, in particular the statements of Louis Farrakhan, but other people as well who come out of that tradition, they make statements that are overtly anti-Semitic and disgusting. And so I was very critical of the NAACP inviting Louis Farrakhan to a national leadership summit that was constituted by them this past June. And this was at the end of 5.5 years of us doing this dialogue. Cornell went to that as one of the leaders who was invited. I was outside organizing a picket, a demonstration against that. So we clearly had a very strong disagreement. And on the one hand, I want to say that a part of our message in this dialogue is that one can disagree in this way, that one doesn't have to impose a political correctness on the other community and say, you have to agree with us on all points, in order to affirm the fundamental unity of purpose and direction between these two communities. But on the other hand, I really disagreed with what was happening there. I think that sometimes people minimize Farrakhan and say, oh, he doesn't have that big a constituency, he's not that important. Then on the other hand, here they are inviting him to the National Leadership Summit and saying he is one of the national leaders. And I think they can't have it both ways. And so I am very disturbed by that. And shortly thereafter, after this whole event, organization's newspaper, the Nation of Islam's newspaper, issued a new teaching by Farrakhan in which he focused specifically on the role of Jews in killing Jesus. Now, this is being raised in 1994, right? This is not about gutter religion, what he said 10 years ago. He's saying in 1994, he issues this statement about how the Jews were responsible for the death of Jesus, and the entire teaching was about that. And what he said in it was that the Jewish people are collectively responsible for the killing of Jesus. So he is raising the thing that has been used against us for 2,000 years as one of the main ways to incite people to hate us. And this is outrageous and unacceptable. And I think that I'm calling on African Americans to repudiate him unequivocally and strongly and consistently until he moves away from this kind of overt anti-Semitism.
Well, Cornell West, what's your reaction to Michael Lerner's call that African Americans should repudiate unequivocally Farrakhan's treatment of Jewish people?
Well, I mean, part of it hangs on what he means by that. If he means that one must bring serious moral critique to bear on anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic language, rhetoric, and action, he's absolutely right. If he means one ought to in no way engage the Nation of Islam or no way engage Minister Louis Farrakhan, I disagree with him. There's no doubt that Minister Louis Farrakhan has made anti-Semitic statements and rhetoric. He's caused Jewish pain. There's no doubt about that. At the same time, I unequivocally oppose the demonization of Minister Louis Farrakhan or anybody else to situate them outside of the human race, to act as if he is a Hitler and therefore a devil and a demon. That strikes me as not just trumping conversation, but it impedes the kind of engagement necessary, especially in the black community, when you have someone who is influential. It's true, numerically speaking, that the National Organization of Nation of Islam is roughly equivalent to the three biggest Baptist churches in Brooklyn in terms of numbers. But he is influential, and therefore there's a struggle going on in the black community for the hearts and minds and souls of black people, especially young black people. So you have to be able to engage, and you engage by means of not simply highlighting his rhetoric as it relates to Jews, but also highlighting his major focus, which is black suffering. And because black suffering has been rendered invisible in America for the most part, you miss much of Minister Louis Farrakhan if all you see is simply his anti-Semitic rhetoric and do not see his focus on black suffering and do not see what is perceived in the eyes of many people, namely his deep love for black folk and his willingness to be bold and defiant vis-a-vis a black power structure. The challenge is going to be, how do we speak to the black suffering? How do we accent the black love and the need for black self-respect, and then in no way associated with anti-Semitic or patriarchal or homophobic language.
Michael, what do you say to Cornell West's idea that Farrakhan speaks to African-American suffering and he should be engaged in dialogue, not demonized?
Well, I'm sure he does speak to African-American suffering, but I've often said that many racists in the United States spoke to the pain and poverty of white Americans. That wasn't sufficient to excuse their racism towards African Americans. Well, and
we're not talking about excusing. We're talking about engaging.
Well, yes, and here I'm all for you engaging privately with this guy. I'm against you giving him, acknowledging him as a leader when he is and inviting him to sit down as part of a leadership conference. When this guy is hurting us and spreading this vicious anti-Semitism against us. Now, I had the same position vis-a-vis our own racists. In other words, We in the liberal Jewish world, Tikkun magazine organized a demonstration against Meir Kahana, who is the rabbi who had racist ideas against the Palestinians and against American blacks. And we would not allow that kind of racism in our own community. We're not holding blacks to a different or higher standard than we hold ourselves. And I was very proud of Israel when Israel threw him out of the Knesset and then passed a law banning any racist party from running for Knesset. I think that that's the appropriate way you deal with overt racists who are unapologetic in their demeaning of others.
Colonel West?
You see, I would argue that there's a number of different strategies here. You see, if I did not engage in dialogue with homophobes, with those with patriarchal sensibility or white supremacists, I would not engage too many people, so that the question becomes, how do you engage with people in light of what you perceive to be their xenophobic sensibility or language, you see? And for me, anti-Semitism is one particular form of vicious bigotry. And I've continually engaged with homophobes, continually engaged with white supremacists, continually engaged with those with patriarchal sensibilities. The question is whether I'm going to be upfront about my own critiques of those forms, even as I try to move them in certain directions.
My guests are Cornel West and Michael Lerner. They collaborated on the new book, Jews and Blacks. We'll continue our conversation in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on new tensions between the U.S. and Japan on trade?
Hi, Terry. The U.S. is planning to challenge the trade imports from Japan in retaliation against what it sees as a mostly closed market for U.S. automotive products in Japan. Other stories, Joanne Silberner reports on the proposal to help balance the federal budget by slowing down spending for Medicare. Martha Raddatz reports that Terry Nichols has now been charged in the Oklahoma City federal building bombing. He had been held as a material witness. Also, a sports roundup, baseball, and Michael Jordan of the Chicago Bulls at playoff time.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guests are Cornel West and Michael Lerner. They collaborated on the new book, Jews and Blacks. Let me tell you something that I think I sometimes hear on the subject of Jewish-African-American relations is addressed, and that is the question of, well, who's been more oppressed? Is the Holocaust the equivalent of the hundreds of years of slavery that African-Americans faced? Which group of people has faced more hardship over the centuries? Is that something that you think the dialogue gets too hung up on?
Oh, very, very much so. And we did see this many times on the tour. But I think it has much to do with the fact that in the last 20 or 25 years, Jewish suffering, especially in the 20th century, as ugly and indescribable as it has been, has in fact received a visibility and a saliency that black suffering has not. And so what you often find is persons deeply concerned about, okay, a Holocaust monument in Washington, D.C., or news coverage of the Holocaust, the genocidal attacks of Nazis vis-a-vis Jewish brothers and sisters, talked about a lot of focus on it. And at the same time, America still in denial about 244 years of slavery or the indescribable cruelties and atrocities of the transatlantic slave trade. So it's not simply engaging in this algebra of blood, as Camus called it, but it's acknowledgement that Jewish suffering in the 20th century has received a validation and a legitimacy in terms of its visibility, that black suffering in America, for the most part, has not, because America remains in a state of denial about its vicious treatment of black folk. And I think that's true for indigenous peoples as well.
Michael Lerner, what's your reaction?
One out of every three Jews alive in the 20th century was murdered. So I wouldn't say that the visibility we got was disproportionate to the outrage. But
that wasn't the claim. The claim was vis-a-vis the history of slavery in America.
Right. Yeah. It's certainly true that there hasn't been enough attention paid to the ongoing legacy of slavery and oppression of African Americans. But here I do think that there's a tremendous problem that comes out of both of our communities. And we love to sing the song, "Nobody Knows the Trouble I've scene. Both of us, both of our communities know how to sing that song and to say, hey, our suffering is more unique and different than everybody else's. But the problem is that insofar as we've been interested in trying to change the situation in the world, and we've, after all, these are the two communities that are the backbone of the liberal and progressive social change movements in America, the African Americans and Jews. Insofar as we wanted to change the situation, we've put out a message that I think has been very destructive and has undermined the liberal and progressive forces. And that message has been that there is a hierarchy of oppression, and that if you want to be part of a progressive social change movement, you've got to first acknowledge that your pain is less than our pain. And that kind of way of orienting towards others, I think, has been extremely alienating and has pushed people away. And part of what Cornell and I came to in the dialogue was realizing that a campaign against anti-Semitism in the black community and racism in the Jewish community wasn't enough, that what we needed to do was to bring, in order to heal the pain between these two communities, we needed to address the larger dynamics and problems in American society as a whole, and to turn to many Americans who are suffering from the ethos of materialism and selfishness in this society, and talk about the deprivation of meaning that is central to the pain that middle-income white people face in this society. All too often, the liberal and progressive forces have said the only real pain is economic deprivation or denial of political rights. But so many people who are facing the breakdown of families, the isolation that comes from living in a world in which everybody seems to be out for themselves, the sense that there are no values in the society, the ethical and spiritual crisis that the right has successfully addressed that affects so many white middle-income people, this is a real oppression that up till now, liberal and progressive forces haven't addressed.
I'd like to end by asking you each to tell us what left you most hopeful from your tour.
For me, what was most hopeful was the response that so many African-American young people gave to the possibility of a black-Jewish alliance, and particularly to the part of the alliance where we talked about bringing these two communities together to challenge the ethos of materialism and selfishness in American society. That was extraordinary, and I felt like there was the energy in many of the rooms that we spoke in for a real campaign for a change in American politics.
Cornell West, we have about 40 seconds.
What was most hopeful was we got an enactment of democratic practice so that you had two fellow citizens who cared about one another, loved one another, engaged in deep disagreement but much deeper agreement so that we could take one another seriously and give each other the benefit of being wrong as well as right. And yet example itself, for me, is so very important in a moment of such polarization and balkanization.
In other words, that it's possible for two people to not agree on everything and yet to recognize their fundamental solidarity and unity and go forward to try and change the larger society without requiring of each other that we be 100% in agreement.
Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Terry.
Cornell West and Michael Lerner, they collaborated on the new book, Jews and Blacks, Let the Healing Begin. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Knopf, publisher of Spontaneous Healing by Dr. Andrew Weil, a guide to the body's natural healing ways. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Oklahoma bombing suspect Terry Nichols has agreed to be transferred to Oklahoma City. He will face charges, along with his friend Timothy McVeigh, in the April 19th attack that killed 167 people. He's being taken to the city immediately. Nichols is specifically charged with the malicious damage to a federal building. A supporting affidavit in the case has been kept sealed. There's new fighting between government forces in Croatia and Serbian rebels, but there is a chance tension may ease, at least for a short time. Mike O'Connor reports.
On one hand, both the Serbs and government troops are reported to still be firing on each other in some areas. Serbs shelled one city today and continue to probe government lines, and both sides continue to hold land ahead of ceasefire lines established by the United Nations. Says while each side has promised repeatedly to withdraw, neither seems to be doing so. The government still has troops either in or surrounding UN observation posts. and is using at least two U.N. positions to fire at Serb soldiers. Still, a senior U.N. military officer says it's beginning to look as if all this is probably bluster, just tension left over from the open warfare last week. And he predicted that within a few days, matters could calm down. For National Public Radio, this is Mike O'Connor in Zagreb.
Trade Representative Mickey Cantor has announced the United States will lodge an auto trade complaint with the new World Trade Organization. The Clinton administration says Japan has shut its markets to U.S. autos. Cantor says the administration will shortly publish a list of Japanese products that could be hit with punitive tariffs. He says the United States is acting on behalf of American companies and American workers. The case will be filed with a new World Trade Organization within the next 45 days. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is recommending what it calls significant reforms to the food stamp program. The recommendations would give states more control over the program but wouldn't turn food stamps into a block grant. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman outlined the proposed food stamp changes in a briefing on the 1995 Farm Bill. The reforms would include measures against fraud and abuse of the $27 billion program and new work and training requirements for able-bodied adults receiving food stamps. Some of the more restrictive federal requirements states have complained about would also be eliminated, but Glickman said food stamps must remain as a federal safety net.
I don't think there's any question the administration is strongly opposed to block granting the food stamp program, but we also remain mindful that there are very significant and needed reforms in that program that we must do.
To better reflect the large role nutrition programs play, Glickman is also recommending a name change to the Department of Food and Agriculture. I'm Peter Kenyon in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up more than 10 points at 4,401. This is NPR. The wives of two Americans jailed in Iraq are spending a last day in Baghdad before leaving. Their husbands won't be with them. Linda Barloon and Kathy Daliberte leave the Iraqi capital tomorrow. Their pleas for their husbands' release have not been answered. The women failed in their effort to petition Iraqi President Saddam Hussein or any other Iraqi official for their husbands' freedom. William Barloon and David Daliberte were sentenced to 8 years in prison each for illegally crossing the Iraqi border. Both maintain they accidentally strayed across the border. Russian President Boris Yeltsin denies Moscow troops are still carrying out military operations in Chechnya. Yeltsin declared a 2-week unilateral ceasefire to observe celebrations marking the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II. But the BBC's Andrew Harding reports on an attack today on an area believed to be held by Chechen rebels.
Russian artillery has again been blasting away at the hills of southern Chechnya. It's not clear exactly what the Russians are aiming at, but much of the shelling appears to be directed towards the frontline village of Serzhen Yurt. The Russian authorities continue to insist that their troops are only firing in retaliation and that the terms of Moscow's unilateral ceasefire are being strictly observed. A Russian military spokesman, quoted by the Interfax news agency, said 38 Chechen fighters and one Russian soldier had been killed in the past 24 hours. Chechen fighters have repeatedly said that they intend to ignore Russia's moratorium, but they've also rejected Russian claims that they're deliberately provoking more bloodshed in order to embarrass President Yeltsin during his summit in Moscow. The war, say the Chechens, is simply carrying on as usual.
Andrew Harding reporting. A Zairean city has been quarantined. More than 100 people have died there from a mysterious disease that scientists have not confirmed. There are fears that it's the deadly Ebola virus. The illness has no remedy and is fatal 90% of the time. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor says the United States will lodge an auto trade complaint against Japan. The complaint will be filed with a new World Trade Organization.
We believe the government of Japan has failed to carry out its obligations under the WTO and continues to thwart the open and equitable trade, which is the objective of the WTO. Japanese government actions have nullified and impaired benefits accruing to the United States and other member countries under the WTO.
Cantor says the United States will also shortly publish a list of Japanese products that could be hit with punitive tariffs. Cantor says Japan has a $37 billion trade surplus with the United States. Mexican officials report a former official who'd been a key investigator into the 1993 slaying of a Catholic cardinal has been murdered in western Mexico. Leobardo Larios, a former attorney general for the western state of Jalisco, was slain by four gunmen as he left home today. Larios had headed the state government's probe into the 1993 murder of Cardinal Juan Posadas Ocampo. He left that job 2 months ago. It's not known if his murder is related to his investigative work. Cardinal Posadas was slain 2 years ago at the Guadalajara airport in what the Mexican government says was a case of mistaken identity in a drug war. Opposition groups and the Catholic Church have rejected that explanation. Final action by the conference at the United Nations to determine the fate of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was expected today, but has now been put off until tomorrow. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
The delay does not throw into doubt the final action of the NPT conference. That is all but certain now, with at least 107 of the treaty's 178 signatories publicly in favor of extending the treaty indefinitely. But the conference has generated a package of measures designed to further the goal of nonproliferation. Among them, support for a comprehensive nuclear test ban, further steps toward the reduction of nuclear arsenals, an almost yearly review of progress toward nuclear disarmament. Governments wanted an extra day to consult on these questions and on an Arab proposal appealing to Israel to join the nonproliferation treaty. Israel has not joined and is believed to possess nuclear devices. It is possible there will be some dispute over the Arab proposal when the conference reconvenes Thursday. I'm Mike Schuster in New York.
A new study by the government finds a growing need for child care during off hours. Labor Secretary Robert Reich says many couples are using desperate measures because of the problem. He says some even leave their children sleeping in cars in workers' parking lots. The study finds more than 14 million Americans work non-standard hours. 7 million are women with children younger than 15. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 14 points to close at a record 4404.62. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. President Clinton addressed the Russian people today at Moscow State University. He urged the nation to stay on the democratic course. NPR's Brooke Gladstone has more from Moscow.
President Clinton praised Russian resilience and strength and the remarkably peaceful nature of its revolutionary transition to democracy. He urged Russians to vote, to support a free press, and to build tolerance in their society. He said Russia and the United States must unite to safeguard the security of their people in fighting terrorism and organized crime. He noted that there was some disapproval of Russia's democratic transition in Russia, just as there was skepticism in the United States, but that future generations would be grateful for Russia's struggle today. President Clinton wraps up the Moscow summit with a breakfast tomorrow with Russian literary figures and others. It was not marked by any significant breakthroughs, though Russia has recommitted itself to joining NATO's Partnership for Peace. Tomorrow, President Clinton flies to Kiev in Ukraine. This is Brooke Gladstone in Moscow.
The New Orleans region is being drenched by a powerful new storm. Another 14 inches of rain fell north of Lake Pontchartrain overnight on top of Monday's 18 inches. The new downpour forced authorities to rescue dozens of residents stranded in their homes by high water. Emergency officials in suburban Slidell warned residents to stay home today since streets were underwater. Two of Louisiana's largest school systems were closed today, Orleans and Jefferson. Several deaths are being blamed on the storm, which has forced evacuations from Mississippi to the Florida Panhandle. Budget committees in the House and Senate are working on Republican spending plans that call for balancing the budget by cutting or getting rid of dozens of federal agencies. Republicans are expected to use their majorities to push through the plans. Both committees are looking for huge savings in Medicare and Medicaid programs. The House wants to see savings of more than $400 billion over 7 years from those two programs alone. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.